Eternal God, in the reading of the scripture, may your word be heard. In the meditations of our hearts, may your word be known. And in the faithfulness of our lives, may your word be shown. Amen. A reading from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 5, starting in verse 21. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. The word of the Lord.
Two daughters of the people. One, like my own daughter Amaya, just 12 years old, the daughter of an authority in the town. The other, a woman bleeding incurably from her lifeless womb for 12 long years. And Jesus addresses her as daughter. The writer of this gospel story has presented these two lives as interwoven, telling us how one touched Jesus while he was on his way to touch the other, who dies so horrifyingly young. An eternity of suffering for one has been nowhere near enough time for the other. The number 12 in this story, I think, is not just a coincidence. By highlighting the 12 years of the sickness of the one and the 12 years of age of the other, the story emphasizes how together these daughters embody the needs of their people, who are known as 12 tribes, the 12 tribes of the family of Israel. These two daughters of the people then are not islands in a sea of nothingness. They're bodies in a fabric of bodies, an intricate web of relationships, daughters of a community. In their bodies and relationships, we're seeing the life and the death of their people. And if we pause to reflect on what the story tells us about each one of them, so much of their suffering is about how they're related to others and how those relationships are broken. How their suffering ripples out from their bodies to be felt by others. For all of his power in the town as the ruler of the town synagogue, Jairus is reduced to kneeling before Jesus and begging for his daughter's life. Her suffering is also his own. Who among us can imagine losing a daughter of 12 years of age? Right as she is beginning to grow into an adult, her life is cut off. A body that holds so much of the memory and the future of not only Jairus, but of the whole community. To lose her is for them to lose a part of themselves. And the woman who has been bleeding for 12 years is not an island either. Presumably, she aches for children that she can't have because of how her hopes for life have been shaped by her community. And I suspect that some of us gathered here know what it's like to ache for children that we can't have. In Jesus' time and place, that ache was probably even more intense because motherhood was so basic to a woman's life, and the inability to conceive a source of shame. Add to this that under God's law governing her community's life, this woman's condition rendered her perpetually unclean, forbidden from maintaining normal contact with her loved ones and other neighbors. The law that God had given to her people through Moses provided for women to be apart from the rest of the community during their time of the month, to highlight and to nurture the life-giving power of their bodies while they shed the blood of life. Several days off every month, or a kind of regular pre-maternity leave, we might say. But in this woman's case, that law means a kind of death, of permanent estrangement from her loved ones and other neighbors. And for them, of course, it means the enduring loss of her nearness. It was a death that grew from her dead womb, a future cut off. So neither of the daughters of this story is an island, and together they picture the brokenness that their people are suffering. And this should not surprise us if we're familiar with the stories of Israel's past. The prophets especially of Israel, use the terms of death and ongoing uncleanness to describe their people when they were terminally ill with injustice and idolatry, being oppressed by other political powers, how they were stuck in patterns of taking advantage of one another instead of caring for each other. And so the way these two daughters of the people embody the needs of their people means that what happens to them in their encounter with Jesus in the story that's been read for us ripples out to affect the fabric that unites them to others. It's not just healing for them, though it is definitely that. It's healing that extends from them with hope for their whole people. Now, I think a sermon on this passage today would be missing something important, would be more tone deaf than it may already be as the work of a male like me, if we did not pause to consider how the story relates to what's been taking place in our neck of the woods lately, as well as in places farther away. A nasty facade over a whole culture of mistreatment of women, especially sexual mistreatment, is being ripped away. Some women have found the courage to expose to the public the disgusting way that powerful men have treated them. And I suspect that many of us are not disgusted enough, or that we're disgusted self-righteously. As they have asked that these men be held accountable and for urgent change in our culture, courageous women have been witnesses to how their perpetrators have gotten away with it, not only because they are men of power and wealth, but because they are men. Because our society has developed a texture of social interactions in order that systematically subordinates women to men, so that women often endure all kinds of undue pressures as they attempt to express themselves, to develop and exercise their gifts and talents, to be duly recognized and compensated for their work. They're commonly interrupted in meetings, commonly taken less seriously in discussions, commonly asked what they did to encourage men to mistreat them, commonly shouldered with inordinate burdens in family and work life, commonly deterred from seeking roles of authority, and it turns out commonly harassed sexually and coerced to provide sick gratification for men. I'm afraid the shock so many of us have experienced at the revelations of recent months is itself a symptom of the disease. This diseased texture of gender relations in our society, indicating no doubt our complicity in it. So many of us, especially us men, had no idea that it was that bad. And yet it is, and we've been oblivious, if not indifferent. Now, I think it'd be naive to imagine that the Bible has been innocent in this common mistreatment of women in our society. But the influence of the Bible has always depended on the way people understand it and the way that they use it. And today I want us to consider what this story about Jesus and two daughters of his people has to say to us in this pregnant moment of our time. The woman who has suffered so intensely for 12 years and spent all the money that she had on doctors only to grow worse, refuses to settle for what she has been enduring. Knowing it is illegal in some sense and that being discovered could mean terrible shame for herself and for others, she braves the crowds following Jesus, pressing in on this person that she has heard about. She doesn't wait for an invitation from Jesus or anyone else to push her way through and to touch Jesus' clothes with her own hand. She acts of her own accord, saying to herself that even touching his clothes will deliver the power of healing that she so desperately needs. And when she does, she senses that her 12 long years of suffering are over, that she is healed. This sharing of power is invisible to this point in the story, and the courageous woman of such immense faith is no doubt happy to slip away clean and unseen, keeping her elation quiet until she can share it with others more discreetly. But Jesus apparently wants more for the texture of life that she shares with others. To his male disciples' dismay, he asks aloud who has touched his clothes, moving to make this woman's touching him public. He keeps looking around, stopping all movement and drawing the gaze of the crowd to what now unfolds. The now healed woman, trembling with fear, finds the extraordinary courage in herself, not just to say enough to get by, but to tell Jesus and all gathered the whole truth, the writer tells us, with all the scandal that that entails. I hope you don't miss the significance of Jesus' response. He does not shame her for disregarding God's law or moving stealthily through the crowd or touching him without permission. He doesn't even say, as I suspect many of us men expect him to, "Congratulations for doing the right thing and trusting me, since I have the power to heal you." He calls her daughter, a member of the family with a future. "Your faith has made you well. Your faith has saved you. Now go in peace and be healed of your disease." Her healing is not a matter of only stopping her hemorrhage and opening her womb to life and ending the uncleanness that has segregated her under God's law. It's also a matter of space for her own voice, for her own visibility to her neighbors, as a daughter among them whose own faith has saved her. Her body had long shuddered with the groans of her people, and now because of her faith, her touch, her voice, her body, the power of her healing is rippling through the whole texture of her community. Notice that her healing does not close with a wedding or a reunion with a husband or her conceiving and birthing children. Perhaps those are in her future, but they're not what makes her future promising, it seems, according to this story. She does not need a husband or children to be a daughter of promise, according to Mark. Marriage and motherhood can be wonderful gifts, but a woman does not need a man to complete her, or children for her to fulfill her calling. In her encounter with Jesus, it's clear that this woman is a daughter of promise because of her faith, her courage, her touch, her voice, and the ways that these gifts of her body will be a womb of life for her community. This encounter with a brave woman of faith has, of course, kept Jesus from answering the prayer of the powerful man in town, Jairus. His daughter has died while Jesus has stopped on his way to Jairus' house. Jesus has insisted on serving at the margins before going to the house of power. And it turns out that he's done that at some cost. When some people come from Jairus' house to tell him that his daughter has already died, not to impose further on Jesus, notice that Jesus tells Jairus, as the ruler of the synagogue, to have the faith of the unclean woman, the faith that saved her. He must not cave to fear and give up on his daughter's life. You can imagine the expectation that these words of Jesus's create, not only for Jairus, but for the whole crowd that is listening to this encounter. And so it's striking that Jesus allows no one to follow him, we're told, to Jairus' house, not even most of his own disciples. He takes only his three closest friends and disciples, Peter, James, and John. The loud rituals of mourning and grief have already begun at Jairus' home, and yet Jesus has the audacity to tell them that their grief is premature, that the girl is only sleeping. How dare he underestimate their loss and Jairus' loss at a time like this? Quite understandably, they've given up on the life of the young daughter of the community lost to the power of death that engulfs their people. Now, I suppose the macho thing to do in this moment to this crowd that is mocking Jesus for him is for him to say, "Oh yeah, well, watch what I can do." That's what would happen in the Marvel universe. Instead, Jesus sends them out of the house, we're told. He takes only the girl's father and mother and his three disciples into where the dead girl is lying, her body now unclean because of death. He takes her hand and he speaks directly to her as one who is able to hear him. Calls upon her to rise out of death back into life. The 12-year-old girl hears and is empowered with life, walking around the room. Her whole future, with all that it means for her family and community, reopened. But then notice, Jesus orders those present, strictly, we're told, not to spread the word of what has happened. The point has not been a spectacle of Jesus' power, but the life of the girl. So instead of running out to tell the world how amazing Jesus is, they should give the girl breakfast after the long night of death. She's a daughter with a future. Of course, she'll soon be seen, and word will spread that she is up and about. But what word will spread, the story leaves us asking? That Jesus brought a dead girl back to life, as we know, or that it turns out she was just asleep? That's what Jesus had told those who had understood she had died. And perhaps the buzz in the town will be that it turns out Jairus' daughter had fallen into a coma and been awoken. So the power of Jesus does not seek an audience primarily for him or use women's bodies as a spectacle of his own might, nor is its aim to prove people wrong about him. The power of Jesus in this story is a matter of encounter with others so that they are filled with life, so that their own lives are able to flourish, to speak for themselves if they have been silenced, to move by their own strength if they have been thrown down. And as we move further into this time of awakening to women's dignity and gifts and power, and to the way we men have stifled them, whether by sick aggression or clumsy obliviousness, I hope we'll learn from Jesus, and especially from these two daughters of his people who have become mothers to us, to avoid making women's needs a spectacle or mere instrument for others' power, especially for men's power. And may we learn, too, the urgency of space for women and girls to speak for themselves and so to influence others, both women and men, according to the power of their own voices, touch, and the other gifts of their bodies, instead of being spoken by others and instead of always letting others to interpret the power of their bodies for them. The result, I think, will not be only more life for them. It will be more life for all of us. Amen.